How does the bacteria in dirt or in our gut or on our body affect our health?
The whole body is connected, and it's connected to the microbiome. So if the body changes, the microbiome changes. That could have feedback upon the body, making the body change even more. So we think the microbiome could play a role in exacerbating symptoms.
Jack Gilbert talks about his new book, Dirt is Good, and answers your questions. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet them to 21STShow. Later, a Supreme Court decision this week on free speech involves the Asian American band The Slants.
I started getting letters from Asian American youth saying, like, thank you for showing me it's possible to be in a rock band. I just knew at that point, like, whether we like it or not, we're going to be judged by our race and that we're going to be seen as representatives of it.
Bassist and founder Simon Tam joins us to share what his decade-long fight means for free speech and the Asian American community. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every new parent, and even those who have been doing this for a while, struggle with how much dirt you should let your child be exposed to. Questions like that, whether or not your child needs antibiotics or even antibacterial wipes, are all tackled by microbial biologist Jack Gilbert of Argonne National Laboratory and the University of Chicago in his new book, Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. We're going to talk about all of those issues now, germs, bacteria, kids, with Jack, and he can answer all of your questions as well. We've got some questions that have already come in on Twitter. Our handle, 21STShow. You can give us a call always as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Hey, Jack, welcome back. Thanks for being here with me. It's fun
My
to have
pleasure.
You here. We're Jackson studio with me here in Chicago. So you start this book with two really personal stories, the birth of your son, the birth of your one of your co-author's children. So your co-author, Rob Knight. Can you share the story of what happened when your eldest son was born?
Yeah. So it was, you know, as every new parent will tell you, it was quite a traumatic experience as well as a joyous experience. But, you know, we had to wait in the hospital room for quite some time, waiting for a doctor to turn up. And my wife was told not to push. Right. So she was desperate to push. She'd been in labor for approximately 8 hours by that point, and she felt it was ready. She wanted to go through. They had her lying on her back, which she felt uncomfortable with, and there was a lot of preamble with the nurses about, you know, you have to do it this way, you have to do it this way. And then so she was not allowed to push, and my eldest son's head was bashing up against the pelvis, right? And so he was born in a distressed state when the doctor, I don't know why we needed a doctor to allow my wife to push, but who finally arrived in the operating room and basically said, no, go for it, push. And she did, and he came out. But by that time, he'd already voided his bowels in the birth canal. And this is called meconium, right? It's a mech. And there was a hypothesis some time ago that this could cause an infection in their lungs if they inhaled it. So he was immediately given antibiotics. And new parent, and I was only 30 years old at the time, I was like, no, do whatever you need to do, absolutely. And it was interesting, in researching this book, we found out that the application of those antibiotics was completely and utterly not called for. The idea that you could give a child antibiotics at birth was purely, well, it can't hurt, so why not? You know, like, it's better safe than, you know, sorry. And in this instance, it turned out that actually antibiotic administration very early in life could have caused disruptions in his microbiome, which, you know, could have led to any number of complications.
Right.
But we didn't know that then, right?
Right. Well, and maybe we should take a step back and talk about and explain exactly what our microbiome is, because this is your field of research.
Right. So our microbiome is the bacteria, the virus, the fungi, the ecosystem of microbes that live inside us. There's around 2 pounds of them living in your gut, but they're all over your skin, over every surface you can imagine. You have microbes swimming in front of your eyes. You just can't see them, right? They're very, very small. And they contain lots of genetic information. They themselves are powerhouses, like little factories that produce resources that your body needs. They help you digest your food. They help train your immune system. They even produce chemicals that stimulate your muscle growth and your bone growth and even your brain development. right? So we know that they're incredibly important for our health and well-being. And when we disrupt them, when we change the composition of them in a negative way, removing good ones and maybe allowing bad ones to grow, we can actually end up with a negative health consequence. Something bad can happen and occasionally does.
But we're born without, we're born with a clean slate.
Essentially, yeah. As soon as the amniotic sac, that's the sac that contains you as a fetus, as soon as that ruptures, you're then exposed to all the microbes in your mother, right? So as you pass down
which
the
is
birth
a good
canal,
thing.
Oh, we think it's a, you know, well, you've evolved with it.
Right.
All of your ancestors went through that process, right? Of traveling down the birth canal and being slathered in this vaginal microbiota that just covered the baby. And then all of the kisses and the hugs and that skin contact. Yeah, you know, it's good for emotional bonding, but it's also good for microbiome bonding because you get that microbial exposure in the child very early in life. And then even breast milk has bacteria in it, right? So feeding the baby breast milk, which has nutrients which only feed the bacteria in the gut, have nothing to do with human nutrition. They're there. Breast milk is designed to feed microbes in the intestine.
So I was fascinated by this. There's a lot that I learned in your book, but the breast milk one was really interesting to me because so you have done research on this, that it's actually, it's not just nutrients for the baby, it's actually nutrients for your gut bacteria.
Right. We have these human milk oligosaccharides, right? So they're like long sugars. And these sugars are designed to be consumed purely by bacteria. The human body doesn't need them. They're not there for our nutrition. They're there to feed bacteria. And there's a reason for
this. And why is that? Yeah, why is that important?
Because the bacteria are like your first line of defense against infection, right? They literally, if you populate your body and your body's designed to do this, right? You populate your body with a beneficial microbial community and a microbial ecology, like a forest around you, it prevents bad things from coming in and taking over. In the absence of those microbes, bad bacteria, bad viruses can rapidly take over your body and cause infection and kill you, right? So kind of want them.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to ask you, you and Rob, who wrote this book, it tackles a lot of female health topics. We've been talking about childbirth, pregnancy, breastfeeding. Why did two male scientists want to do that?
I know, right? There's a gender bias. We do have Sandra Blakesley, who's our other co-author. She's a passionate science writer. She was the first female science writer in the United States, the second female journalist at the New York Times in 1962. She's 74 years old and can race me up a hill on a bike and beat me every time. Right. So I agree. You know,
I'm just curious why you chose that, because you do go into all of these different topics.
I love my children, right? That's the key thing. And Rob's got a daughter. He loves her. And, you know, we're very passionate about finding ways to help treat other children so they don't suffer from conditions that many kids suffer from nowadays, like asthma and food allergies and eczema and neurodevelopmental conditions like autism problems with school, you know, like school readiness and all these kinds of things. Diabetes, we want to make sure that children grow up and are exposed to the right kinds of things and are brought up healthy. But more importantly than that, every time you ask a man a question, we try and solve it, right? That's a problem. Like, you just want to complain. I just stop trying to answer my questions. Just let me complain, okay? I get that, but I really want to have questions answered. So for us, it was really important. We went through some traumatic experiences, and we wanted to empower parents with the knowledge that we had gained through scientific investigation, through clinical research, right? We wanted to empower people with that knowledge so that then when they were faced with those trials, they could deal with it. Right?
Well, and back to the breastfeeding question, right? Because your co-author, Rob, had a situation. I was actually just talking to a friend about this week. Who wasn't able to nurse her daughters and was shamed for it. And she, right. we had a long conversation about how frustrating it was that she felt like this is something she wanted to do and her body couldn't do, and then everyone made her feel bad about it. And you guys talk about this.
Yeah, it's a horrible situation, right? This shaming in our society is prolific. And in this instance, yeah, I mean, you should never feel shamed if your body can't do what it's, you know, what you hope it could do, right? Men have suffered from that for many years, don't worry. But in this instance, yeah, there's a real problem in dealing with the methodologies which could be applied to people, the learning and education which could be given to mothers to help them breastfeed, right, when they can't. But then if they really physiologically can't, there are lots of other options. There are milk banks.
Right, which is what your co-author did.
Right. It's expensive. You know, getting milk from a reliable, well-curated milk bank that's out there. A doula nurse would potentially be another option. So providing somebody who could come in and help breastfeed the child. They're all expensive options, though. And, you know, for a lot of the people in our society, they are completely out of the remit. We hopefully will get to a time when you could include those on your medical insurance, right, as an actual necessary expense to help with preventing later diseases, which would cost the insurance companies much more money, right? So we're not there yet. We need far more evidence to support the development of that, because that's the way our medical system works.
And I was interested in that story, though, because your co-author did end up using formula as well. But it did in a very interesting scientific way in terms of looking at the research, right?
Right. So we know that, you know, certain formulas are better than others in terms of how they help the bacteria in your gut grow and how they stimulate your immune response. So, yeah, he worked very extensively in trying to understand which kinds of formulas could be applied and how to balance this necessity for human milk with a necessity for actually living your life without going bankrupt, right? So, there's a lot of research that's being done in that space and lots which we need to do more of.
My guest is Jack Gilbert. His new book is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. If you have questions for us, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We got a question on Twitter from Chicago saying, fun fact, backyard dirt may be poop, and then asking how much of backyard dirt is actually fecal matter, and can we get illnesses from it?
Nearly all of the dirt or soil, right? You've got to be careful.
Difference between dirt and soil.
There is, yeah. I mean, you know, not in the popular imagination, but from a scientific discipline.
So give us this, go. Maybe you should explain that then.
Well, I mean, like, dirt is just a vernacular term used to describe anything.
Anything, right.
Yeah, right. But soil in the backyard is really what we're referring to in terms of, you know, go out there and get muddy, right? And a lot of the soil out there, as long as you are not concerned about there being too many heavy metal pollutants or industrial waste or, you know, organic pesticides or inorganic pesticides that have contaminated that soil, you'd have to consume a lot of that soil. A child would have to consume a lot of that soil to poison them. But bear in mind, soil is basically reconstituted plant matter. It's already been through the intestine of thousands of insects. It's been digested by bacteria and fungi. So all soil is poop, right? If you look at it literally.
Okay.
But yeah, if you're worried about an area where your dog goes and does their business in the morning, or if you're living on a farmyard and you're worried, you know, if your child's playing in a cow pat, you know, like a cow paddy in the field, yeah, you might want to observe them and make sure that they're staying healthy and they're not coming down with any kind of inflammation or temperature. But on the whole, even those kind of environments aren't necessarily dangerous. Yes, there is always the possibility that a child could get an infection. But what we're concerned about is the fact that the possibility of an infection is quite low, extremely low in many cases, and the possibility of beneficial interaction with that environment is quite high. So balancing your perspectives and using common sense, you know, too many times people want exact instructions. Tell me exactly what I should do so I don't make a mistake. Well, you're allowed to make mistakes. As a parent, you know that, right? You learn that very quickly. And mistakes happen, but getting out there and experiencing the world in a more holistic fashion is not a bad thing.
And that's why you guys got a dog.
Right, yeah. So we know from clinical studies that having exposure to dog bacteria, pardon me, and dog viruses, it can actually help to stimulate the immune response of a child and prevent them from developing things like asthma and allergies and eczema, right? Now, you know, the evidence out there may be a little bit scant in the fact that we haven't done a huge number of double-blind clinical trials with placebos, because how do you create a placebo for a dog, right, that allows us to determine their pure efficacy. But we went and rescued two dogs. The dogs got a better life. My children are exposed to the right kind of environment, and they love going outside and walking them.
But they're not allergic to them, because there's a whole other question, right, about allergies and what kind of role allergies play also with our microbiome, and particularly with our gut bacteria.
Yeah, there's an interesting paradigm. If your child is exposed to a dog, and when I mean exposed, they're allowed to interact physically with the dog. The dog licks their face, they lick the dog's face, whatever happens, you know. If they're allowed to do that kind of physical interaction with the dog under the age of one, they have an almost highly significant reduction in the likelihood of developing an allergy to the dog.
Oh, interesting.
But if it happens afterwards,
age one.
Yeah, if they haven't had any exposure and they've lived a relatively sterile life, then what happens is their immune system generally becomes more pro-inflammatory, right? It's more sensitized to allergens that come from the outside. It hasn't been trained enough. I like to think of the immune system in an infant that isn't exposed to any bacteria as being old and grumpy. So when something new comes into it, it gets very inflamed very rapidly. And so we see, lack of exposure early on can lead to more allergies later on.
And so under age one, is that sort of the key time from birth to one that we see, that you think about, that you have, really are you thinking about exposure to different allergens?
Absolutely, yeah. So, if a child is exposed to, orally exposed, like they're consuming peanuts, for example, under the age of one, they're less likely to develop a peanut allergy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge controversy. But, that now the National Allergy Association is saying, yes, absolutely, please, let's consider
oral consumption.
Right,
those are the new guidelines.
Exactly.
Right. And so then the same thing goes for anything else, you would say, for dirt, for pollen, for pets, and all of those sorts
right.
of things.
Yeah, bear in mind, your children nowadays, thankfully, are protected against the vast majority of extremely highly contagious infective agents, bacteria and viruses which will kill you. So we've got that protection in place. Vaccines and public health works have done their job, right? But we can't live that sanitary lifestyle where we are completely cutting off our children from that exposure. It's too dangerous.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jack Gilbert, talking about all of these things, germs, bacteria, kids. He can answer your questions as well. I see that question on Twitter. We'll get to those as well. If you want to keep tweeting, our handle's 21STShow. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We'll continue this conversation after a short break. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. We're talking about germs and bacteria in kids with microbial biologist Jack Gilbert. He's the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Laboratory. He's also a professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. We're taking your questions, your tweets. Give us a call. Our handle's 21STShow. The phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Lynn on Twitter wants to know what you think about the current data on pre-birth exposure, and maybe you should explain what pre-birth exposure is, Jack.
Yeah, so what we call pre-birth exposure is there's two phases of this, right? Number one, what's your mother being exposed to even before she gets pregnant, right?
Okay.
How her immune system, her microbiome, her physiological health. What's the status of that and how could that affect the pregnancy and the development of pregnancy? And then also, of course, when the mother is pregnant, the kinds of exposures she gets and how that affects the developing fetus. There's some, personally, we're doing some really interesting research in this space. We work with animal models mostly, right, because we do everything in preclinical phase. We can't just go around randomly experimenting on humans, however much I would love to do that. But essentially what we do is we look at how the mother will respond to a viral infection during pregnancy. And a mother that gets a virus infection during pregnancy can actually have an increased risk of a preterm birth, increased risk of placental damage, and even developmental problems in the fetus, which can lead to neurological problems in the developing child, right? And when the child's born, they can have things like autism or other neurodevelopmental problems. And what we've shown is that by increasing the integrity of the microbial ecosystem, by strengthening the microbial ecosystem in the gut during the pregnancy in our animal models, we can actually significantly reduce the likelihood that when we expose that animal to a virus, that it will affect the pregnancy at all. So the fetus is protected from the virus infection by the mother's gastrointestinal microbial environment. So gut health may be a key phase in helping to prevent the development of some of these conditions which children suffer from, and maybe even reducing preterm birth.
So then gut health gets us to probiotics, right? Because I feel like this is the new thing. Everybody is really into probiotics and how this is going to help boost our immune system. This is also a very new area of research. Mm-hmm. First of all, can you explain, what do we know about probiotics?
Well, listen, probiotics is surprisingly not new. We've known that microbial exposure from fermented foods, for example, so yogurts and kefir and fermented milk products generally, and even other fermented foods like kimchi and sauerkraut, can actually be beneficial, right? Over the last 100 years, 150 years, there have been experiments done with these foodstuff by nutritionists that have suggested they can be beneficial. The problem is we now got into this idea that we don't want to ferment our own food at home. You know,
you want to take a pill that's a probiotic.
Right, exactly.
Or a drink, a
and
shot.
We have no evidence that any of these pills, which are like sanitized versions of the home-brewed kefir or home-brewed, you know, yogurts that we had at home, whether this pill is a sanitized version of that. We have no real evidence that it's beneficial in maintaining health. Right. We do have a lot of evidence that taking a probiotic when you're sick. So, for example, if you have diarrhea, you could take a probiotic called Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG, and it can be highly effective in treating the diarrhea. And there are many other probiotics which have been applied in double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trials. That's our gold standard to show that it works, it's effective, that have shown that probiotics can be useful in treating infections and other maladies, right, including things like depression. Which is quite surprising, you'd think, you know, but you take a probiotic and it can affect how your brain works. And things like rheumatoid arthritis. So we know that there are benefits from taking probiotics. But I would argue that until we have a better handle on how to measure health, we're going to struggle to prove that continuous consumption of a pill containing a few organisms in a few hundred billion cells, right, is actually beneficial for maintaining health.
Well, and what do we know about the probiotics that are commercially available as well? There's really only like one or two different strains, right? There's lots of different, and you have in your book, you have a great chart that sort of explains different strains and what, as you've said, what clinical trials have shown are very helpful.
Right.
But I feel like when you look at labels of all of the commercially available stuff, it seems like kind of there's like two or they'd say like this has this many strains of this active culture.
Right. I mean, there are probably 15 to 20 strains that are commonly used in a range of probiotics you could buy in your drugstore or your supermarket. What do you call them? Not supermarket, that's the English
grocery store,
thank you. And they're owned by approximately two or three companies, right? There are two or three companies that own probably 95% of all the probiotics out there.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they're pretty much just recapitulations of the same thing with different branding. And you know, for the most part, there's limited evidence to support their efficacy. But there are some out there. There are a couple that have good clinical data to support their treatment of certain conditions. Like there's one that has been shown to treat irritable bowel disorder, or at least lessen the symptoms of irritable bowel disorder to a certain extent, right? And others that have been shown to treat diarrhea, others have been shown to treat rheumatoid arthritis, others that have been shown to affect change in your susceptibility to viral infections. The data is still limited. The companies are unregulated in their ability to produce some of these products. So unless they're going to make a very specific claim, which would require FDA approval and make them show that they aren't snake oil, right? unless they're going to make that specific claim, they can make any claim they really want to.
My guest is Jack Gilbert. We're talking about probiotics right now. One of the topics of his book, which is called his new book, just out in the past couple of weeks, is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. And as you say that, I wonder, as a scientist, what your thoughts are about a placebo effect of taking
right.
these things. Like, does the fact that we're taking something like You know, like I was telling you before we went on air that I went through this phase where I was doing like a probiotic for, I would just do it for like 7 days. And then I did feel like when I was around my nieces and nephews who had like pretty bad stomach illnesses that I got off a little easier than they did. But is, I mean, that's, as you would say, that's not a science. There's, that's not a clinical trial,
unfortunately,
right?
I mean, we call that an N of one study. There's you. And, you know, who knows what's going on inside you at that time.
Right.
You could have just not picked up the bug, which your nieces and nephews
right.
had. Listen, we require more evidence to support claims, right? And I think that's very important. And a placebo effect is a real thing. You know, if I tell you that this is going to help you, and I actually deal with this in the last chapter of the book, right?
Right, yeah.
If I talk to a patient and I say, this is going to make you feel better, they'll take it and they probably will feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it will cure their problem is very unlikely, right? So we have to be very, very careful about how we use our authority in relaying this science to the public. And you do as well as a journalist. It's a partnership, and it's an honor to be able to communicate the science to the public. But it's also a huge responsibility to make sure that we do it in an effective and controlled way.
Well, and you write about this, right? It's particularly hype when it comes to media issue of coverage pertaining to gut health. There's always sort of a new study about this or that. How do you want people, sort of the average public media listener or news consumer, to distinguish hype from truth when you're looking at sort of these issues?
Well, the cynical side of me is like, buy my book and read it, because that's the reason we wrote it, right? You know, in fact, when we put the idea to our publishers, or the number of publishers, they said, well, we can get all this information on the internet. I said, you can get a lot of information on the internet, right? And yes, you can, but how do you know which is the real information, which isn't? So, you know, coming from two scientists with well-established careers who really don't have a dog in the game or a skin in the game, as it were, you know, with regards to the commercial application of this research, we wanted to show, we can basically encapsulate what is actually known about this research. And here it is. This is essentially what we know now, right? And what you can rely on. And it provides you with essentially it's an encyclopedia, right? I have questions and answers.
Right, it is. There's questions and answers. You can look them up. It's very helpful charts and things. That said, what do you think is one of the biggest myths that you want to dispel about bacteria and germs?
Well, the biggest myth and the most obvious one, right, is that not all bacteria are bad. And I've had clinicians, I've had heads of hospitals stand up in my lectures sometimes and go, there's no such thing as a good bacteria. The only good bacteria is a dead bacteria, right? And that's just literally not true.
And do you think that the medical community has come around to sort of changing their thinking on that, or is that something that's a lot slower in terms of a cultural perspective?
It's we are going through a true Kuhnian paradigm shift, right? A true paradigm shift in the fact that the community, the social community, the business community, and the scientific community is undergoing a revolution in its understanding of the role of this microbial world inside us and outside us. And it's telling, I'm an ecologist, a microbial ecologist, but I'm now a professor of surgery, right? So the University of Chicago is actively embracing this research area and basically trying to transcend the basic environment and bring it into the clinical science so that we can help patients more effectively with these novel therapies.
Well, and how much of this also is just a recognition of where we are with antibiotic use, with the rise of different superbugs, particularly in hospital settings, things like MRSA, people being very concerned about hospital-acquired illnesses and our ability to fight them off.
So we are actually changing that strategy as well, right? There's only so much we can clean something. And as soon as a human being goes into a clean space, they shed bacteria into that environment. And then they enter into this rapid equilibrium where they're picking up bacteria and shedding bacteria. You and I are sitting in this studio, and each of us is shedding 38 million bacterial cells into this environment every hour. So for the hour we're spending in here, we're shedding, you know, close to, you know, 70, 80 million.
And how long does
million.
It stay? So then how long does it stay?
Most of them die as soon as they hit this environment because it's dry and it's cold, right?
Okay.
And they can't survive. It's like a desert. I drop you in a desert, you're going to die, pretty much. But some will survive. The hardier ones will survive. And then you'll pick them up again. So you and I are sharing microbes. And my microbes are testing your immune system. Your microbes are testing my immune system. And the same thing happens in a hospital. Some of them go backwards and forwards, and as they do that, they develop antibiotic resistance. They develop virulence mechanisms which help them to attack the body more effectively. And those are the bugs we worry about. But instead of treating the hospital, what we're most interested in doing now, and this is new research, is to test or treat the microbes inside the patient. Make their microbial environment more robust, less sensitive to stress, right? Because your microbes get stressed as well, just the same as you do. And when we reduce their stress, they become less angry. They're less likely to attack our body.
So that said, as we think about, are we too clean? Do we clean our houses too much, or should we let them get dirtier? Are we thinking of everyone uses antibacterial wipes all the time? I think we've maybe learned a little bit to come away from just constant hand sanitizing. But what do you think about that?
It's a balance, and it's always an annoying answer, right? But you do not need to treat your home like a hospital. Right, you do not need to sterilize every surface with bleach. You do not need to bleach your floors and bleach your countertops and bleach your toilets and bleach your handrails. And you do not need to use hand sanitization wipes in most instances. You need to apply common sense. If you're chopping up raw chicken in the kitchen, wash your hands afterwards and wash the surfaces with soapy water, right? You know, make sure you apply that common sense. That's logic, right? But you don't need to sterilize. The bacteria in the home, coming from your dog, coming from outside, they are not harmful in any particular way, unless your child or you have severe immunocompromisation, in which case you'll know to be careful, right? Or you're very, very unwell, in which case you should be in a hospital, then the home environment is not a dangerous environment. But there's aesthetics. I like the house to be clean, right? I like it to look neat and tidy. That's purely my personality. But it doesn't mean that it has to be sterile. And there's a difference between hygiene and sterility.
And so does that mean, and you write about this, that you have the 5-second rule when you drink, right? When your kids drop food on the ground or anyone does, the 5-second rule's okay?
My rule's probably more like 5 minutes. But you know, like, if the food falls on the floor, the likelihood that the food acquires a pathogen, which when you then pick it up and consume it and will make you violently sick, it's an infinitesimally small chance. Unless you drop it in a slum in Calcutta, for example, where there are people with endemic diseases and there's raw sewage on the ground, in which case you don't want to eat the food off the floor. If you drop it on your floor, it's incredibly unlikely you're going to pick up anything.
And what this also gets to, also, as we're thinking about cleanliness, I want to ask you one last question about antibiotics, because this is a really tough question for parents, right? In terms of, especially with children, what do you think of? We just have a couple minutes left here, but I wanted to kind of end by asking you about that.
Sure. So the best advice is, antibiotics are a line of defense which have saved millions and millions of lives. They are incredibly helpful. If you have an infection, you should probably take an antibiotic, but have an active discussion with your healthcare provider. Don't use them as a prophylactic, right? Somebody said that our president is now using them as a prophylactic. That's not a good idea, right? It's not a sensible thing to do, and it could lead to severe anxiety and depression. Maybe that's what's happening. We don't know. But in this instance, I would say have an honest discussion with your healthcare provider. They are nearly always willing to have that talk and to listen to you. They're more paranoid that you're going to ask them to give you an antibiotic now, and they'll just give it to you to get them out of their office.
So for your perspective, parents, caregivers, everyone just needs to be more empowered about,
right,
does my child really need antibiotics?
Absolutely.
And
I guess
you would say the same thing for adults as well.
Yeah, I ask that question every time I need to take one or my kids need to take one. Ask a question. Do I really need this?
Right. And I guess it's sort of a little bit of that is the philosophy of all of this, right? In terms of probiotics, dirt, all of these things.
Diet, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Just one last question before we wrap up. I wanted to just ask you about prebiotics really quickly.
Well, prebiotics are just food, right? So it's the food that feeds the microbes. So like those human milk oligosaccharides in breast milk that feed the bacteria, fiber, good sources of vegetable matter, good nutrients. They are prebiotics which feed your microbiome and can make them more healthier and stronger.
Yeah. So basically all of the things we thought we should consume before anyway, because they're healthy.
My
right?
mother tells me it's all what she knew already, right? So that's a good thing.
Jack Gilbert, we've been talking, is a professor in the Department of Surgery at the University of Chicago. He's also the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Laboratory. And his new book is called Dirt is Good, The Advantage of Germs for Your Child's Developing Immune System. Jack, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nina.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When Simon Tam founded the Slants 11 years ago in Portland, Oregon, he wanted to make sure that younger Asian Americans could see themselves represented in the rock music scene. Their music's been compared to 80s rock groups like The Cure and Duran Duran, as well as more modern artists like The Killer. They call their sound Chinatown Dance Rock. And the band name, The Slants, was also part of a long legal battle that found its way to the Supreme Court. Earlier this year, government attorneys argued their name shouldn't be trademarked because it was offensive. And this week, the Supreme Court unanimously sided with their case, and the Slants now have the right to trademark their name. It's been all over the news this week. Simon Tan is the founder and bassist of the Slants, and he's on the line with us now from Portland. Hey, Simon, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So this legal battle's been going on for nearly a decade. I wonder, what was the first thing you did when you found out that you guys had won the case?
I checked Twitter.
to make sure honestly, it was really true.
Well, I found out through Twitter. I woke up, it was early in the morning. I had just been working all weekend long. So I was kind of groggy and forgot that it was a possible Supreme Court decision day. And my phone was going crazy. So when I checked it, I was like, oh, I missed 700 messages and calls. Something must have happened. So I hopped on Twitter, and the first thing I saw was, public radio with a tweet saying that the Supreme Court ruled in our favor. So I immediately went to my email box to look for something from my attorney, because that really can mean any number of things. I didn't really quite understand what the ruling was, what the opinion was. So I opened it, he had an email that said, congratulations, and it had the decision attached. And that was the depth of the analysis I had. So I started reading it, and, maybe on page 4 or 5, the calls kind of began. And I was just kind of on this media roller coaster for the next 10 or 12 hours. So really, I didn't even have a chance to process, to respond, to think about how things would, how I was even feeling. Like, I didn't eat. I was just in one call after another.
And so let's rewind back. And for people who are not familiar, can you share where the name The Slants came from and why that was so important for you to have this for the name of the band?
Sure. Well, for me, the name came, the band, the whole idea of the group came from wanting to provide a bold portrayal of Asian American culture, wanting to provide representation. The band existed as an idea before the band name even came about. When I started thinking about band names as a possibility, I started asking my friends. I said, what's something you think all Asians have in common? And they would immediately say, slanted eyes, which I always thought was interesting, because I was like, this is not true. Like, not all Asians have slanted eyes. We're not the only people who have any kind of slant to our eyes. But as I started thinking more deeply about it, I thought, we could really talk about our perspective, our slant on life of what it's like to be people of color while paying homage to Asian American activists who had been using slant in this reappropriated manner for about 30 or 40 years now. So it was just a great way to kind of use our art as a platform to drive this activist approach of trying to bring more nuance into these ideas and conversations about false stereotypes that people hold about us.
And it's kind of wild, because when did you find out that you couldn't trademark this name because it was offensive?
That was early 2010. So we'd already been touring and playing in this band for 3 years, playing at Asian American cultural festivals throughout the country, rock clubs. We had a couple of releases under our belt already. And so it was quite a shock to me that the trademark office said our name was disparaging to persons of Asian descent. But not only that it could possibly be disparaging, but that they said it was highly disparaging to a substantial composite of Asians. And I remember thinking, we've been working for our communities for years now. Who did they find who's actually offended by it? But they couldn't cite a single Asian American who had issues with our name. So they instead quoted UrbanDictionary.com, which is, of course, a joke wiki website. And it was just kind of outrageous that the federal government was using its full power to deny us rights based on a joke website.
Well, and also, you're Asian, like I'm Asian, right? Because I think this is part of the conversation about names and stereotypes and derogatory things, is that there is sort of, I imagine for you, like you feel like there's also a lot of, not just this is a First Amendment issue, but there's also, I think, I would imagine for you, part of reclaiming sort of your identity. And I imagine that's a lot that's also behind this name.
Absolutely. And that was kind of a big part of the principles on which we fought for, that as people of color, we've never had agency over our own identities. We've always had stereotypes used against us. So for us to shift that power dynamic and say, you know what, we're going to claim this, we're going to own it and can reappropriate it, that was a pretty significant shift. And but to have that stripped away because of one random examining attorney at the trademark office to take that away from us was kind of devastating from an emotional kind of perspective.
Simon, there's also, I think, a little bit of an irony in this that I wonder if you see this, that that this case is around Asian Americans, an Asian American term that's offensive, because I feel like a lot of times in the Asian American community, there's even just a whole conversation about, is there even racism against Asian Americans? I wonder if that's also for you, you find it a little ironic that this whole case also hinged on something that was Asian.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, I think what this case really helps illustrate is that our group is extremely diverse. We're not a monolithic group. I mean, the Asians are one of the few kind of racial categories just bound by geography. And it at some points included some countries and other points did not. So it's not surprising that we have diverse opinions about where Asian American rights are. But I think this case, you know, I've been really humbled that it's a part of this larger conversation to put it in the forefront once again. I mean, there's only been about half a dozen cases before the Supreme Court that really dealt with Asian American issues. And so this kind of reiterated the fact that, hey, we're not quite as post-racial as we thought. And our communities are disparately impacted by some laws in ways that we didn't imagine before.
And that is a whole interesting thing, that you and I are in the same racial category in this country, right? My family is Indian by way of the Caribbean, but I'm Asian American, as are you, who is a Chinese American from San Diego. I wonder for you, this case, sort of this kind of the agency that you feel like you have been talking about, how much you think this sort of represents kind of thinking about Asian Americans and Asian American activism in this country and people sort of rallying behind identity. Do you feel like we're in a different place right now with that?
I think our community is still kind of mobilizing. We're still figuring out how to use power and also to try and get beyond these little boxes we've put ourselves in. And traditionally, the whole idea of being Asian American is a fairly new one. Prior to that, we were just Chinese, we were just Koreans, or whatever kind of countries we're descended from. But the Asian American movement really kind of became this rallying cry a couple decades ago to say, you know what, we're much better, we're much more powerful if we're unified, if we can have this bigger base to work from to try and shift power. So I think we're still trying to figure out what that means, especially because we know that Asian Americans are quite diverse in our approaches. Some are far, far left, some are far, far right. And so how do we use this kind of shared identity, at least in a loose sense, in a way that can articulate values that represent all of us?
And is it a strange place for you as a musician? Did you think that you would find yourself in the middle of all of this activism? Because ultimately, you know, this is about your band, right?
Yeah, we are a band. We're not just a, you know, set of law junkies or anything like that. But I don't think anyone could have imagined all this to happen. You know, when I started the band, it was simply about representation. It was because this was in 2004 when I had the band idea name, pre-YouTube even. And when I was like, I couldn't think of a single Asian American artist who had been on the cover of Rolling Stone or Spin. I couldn't think of any Asian American artist highlighted by MTV or Billboard. And I wanted to change that. I thought, you know, there's 17 million Asian Americans. At least back then there were. Now we have more. But I was like, how many Asian American artists could I even think of? And at the time, I couldn't think of any. I was like, well, there's that dude in Smashing Pumpkins, and that's kind of about all I had. So for that to kind of shift into what we're doing now is it was something I couldn't quite imagine at the time. I only got hints of it a few months after we started, because I started getting letters from Asian American youth saying, like, thank you for existing. Thank you for showing me it's possible to be in a rock band. And then I just knew at that point, like, if we're going to be advancing our this band, whether we like it or not, we're going to be judged by our race, and that we're going to be seen as representatives of it. And so we better really be on point. We better know our stuff when it comes to racism and, you know, things affecting equity, diversity, inclusion. And that's how we kind of got started in that work. We started leading workshops and oftentimes doing anti-racism seminars on behalf of the U.S. government, ironically.
Yeah. So I wonder, what have you been hearing from fans of the band throughout the case? What have you been hearing from folks this week? And also, I'm thinking other, like you're saying, your young Asian American fans.
I think that a lot of people are really excited. They know how long we've been fighting for this case. So our fans, people who've been there since the beginning, who've kind of watched this case evolve, are really excited to see that we finally have been vindicated and to some degree. So they're definitely excited. And kind of people who are a little bit newer, who don't really understand all the nuances of, say, this 70-year-old bit of trademark law that's actually fairly obscure, are still trying to understand what it all means. But I think as a whole, most people have expressed a lot of appreciation for the advancement of the First Amendment.
Yeah. Just last question for you. We wanted to play a song of yours here. It's actually called From the Heart. This is your open letter you wrote to the trademark office, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And has this case inspired any more music for you? Are you going to keep writing? I wonder, is there going to be a Supreme Court version of this soon?
You know, I'm not sure, because it was a challenge to write about this in a kind of personal way for a while. I kept telling my band that it would be a great idea, but I said, you know, writing about obscure trademark laws doesn't make good art. That sounds like a
That's not going to get you on the cover of Rolling Stone, you don't think?
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was just so corny. I was like, this is not good. But my guitar player, like, sat with it and wanted to talk about this larger idea. Like, sure, it's an open letter to the trademark office, but it's also addressed to people who have doubts about kind of what we do, people who have doubts about, you know, reappropriation, and it wanted to be this kind of sincere message to them, saying, like, yeah, you know, we're sorry that if you take offense by what we do, we're sorry that if you don't kind of quite understand what we're trying to do, even though it does benefit everybody. And so we're trying to explain, there's like a line in there that says the language of oppression will lose to education. And it's kind of like, yes, you know, we need to move beyond treating racial slurs as the end-all be-all of racism and move towards those institutionalized forms of discrimination that are prevalent in our culture.
On that note, let's end with From the Heart. I want to thank Simon Tam, founder and bassist of The Slants, talking to us about the Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court unanimously sided with The Slants this week. Hey, Simon, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sorry if I know it's too sharp. sorry if our voice is too raw. Don't make the pen a weapon and censor our intelligence until our thoughts mean nothing at all. Sorry if you take offense.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. That's our handle. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.